evening. Can everybody hear me? I'm Deborah Elston. I'm the president of Santa Cruz Neighbors, and I have a couple other board members to introduce. Beth, raise your hand. JD, raise your hand. Is there anybody else here I didn't see come in the door? No. And we are a nonprofit. We do have a basket at the back door. We are very minimal in what we use and how we use our donations, but we appreciate anything. It always helps. And I thank you all for being here. Tonight we have our Chief of Police, Andy Mills. We have our Public Works Director, Mark Devil. And we have our City Attorney, Tony Condotti. And they will be able to answer your questions. So, as the Chief goes along, I think he's going to ask for information or feedback after every goal that he wants to discuss. I will be with the microphone. I will be happy to come to you if you put your hand up after each one, and you will be able to ask your questions. We really don't need huge stories, because we all have stories. What we need is either a solution, or it could be as simple as just a question that maybe needs to be addressed in the goal, or it may be, I have an idea from another city, in which case, that's great as well, because we can always use other resources within the state of California that we're looking for. So, without further ado, and they're not going to use microphones, so that's why I say, raise your hand, I will come to you after each goal and question, and they will be addressing each one. Okay? Thank you.
Well, good evening. Can you hear me in the back okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. If not, I'll talk a little bit louder, but I don't know if that's going to be necessary. So thank you for taking your time to come and help us think through these enormous issues that we have in our city. And, you know, you hear a lot of people commenting on both ends of the spectrum, and what we're trying to do is find solutions to some of the behaviors that bother a lot of people. I want to be clear up front. This is not about homelessness. It is not. We are not going to solve homelessness by adding a couple more ordinances. All we're trying to do is control the behavior of some, both homeless and housed, who are problematic in our community. And so what we're doing is we're promulgating about seven policies that what I'm trying to do is get a sense from the community how much support there are for these policies, these ordinances, and what kind of adjustments need to be made in order to make them effective. So that's the purpose of this, is to sense from the community, to give the information out to the community, to get feedback from the community, and as Deb said, you may have better solutions. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, I can tell you that. But at least we're having the motion to at least push stuff forward and then see what council wants to do. Council's the one that promulgated, that officially puts in place ordinances, not the police department. So that's the purpose of this. So I'm going to go through these one at a time. I think what would be best is after each one, if you have some questions or some thoughts or some clarity that you think is needed, we're in the research stage of this, and so we can go back to ground zero or back to the drawing board and make the adjustments that we need to make. So that's the purpose of this, and hope you take it from that perspective. Again, let me emphasize one more time. This is not going to solve any homeless problems. The purpose is to control behaviors that affect our businesses, that affect our communities, that affect our citizens, both housed and unhoused. And so that's the purpose of this. And I think you'll see that as we go through, hopefully. So goal number one is to reduce needle litter in our city. And the purpose of this is so we don't have as many syringes out and about in the community. So therefore, what I'm proposing is that we ban all syringes out of any park or on the beach in the city of Santa Cruz. You can't possess them there unless there's a genuine medical need. So if somebody has diabetes or going through IV at the time or something of that nature where they absolutely have to have a needle, then obviously we want people to be healthy. Again, this is where our children live and play, and so we want to be able to reduce the amount of needle litter at those locations by saying you just can't have a needle here. State law, you can go and buy a needle or a syringe at Rite Aid, at CVS, anywhere you want. You can get them handed to you by the county in the harm reduction sense. And so you can possess needles. We just don't want them in our sensitive areas, our parks, and our beach. So that's goal number one. Feedback on goal number one. Sir?
Have you thought of having a buyback program? Does it need a dollar needle?
Have we looked into a buyback program for needles?
The question is a buyback program. We have discussed that, kind of like a California redemption value on needles. If you did a nickel a needle, that would add up to about $20,000 a year. If they're collecting 500,000 needles, so that's actually a good thought. So we have thought about that. It has not been proposed, but you can certainly record that and make sure that may be part of the consideration.
What's the penalty and enforcement ideas about this?
Well, that becomes a question for council, but most of our city ordinances are infractions. And I believe $50 fine is the max on that. According to the city attorney, yes. So it'd be a $50 fine. If one's convicted, if the courts choose to impose that fine. Just as part of that, though, let's be pretty clear about this. We write about 11,000 tickets a year.
Yeah.
Of those 11,000 tickets a year, about 8,700 go to people without addresses. About 92% of those do not appear on those citations. So, again, we want to be realistic and pretty pragmatic about how we do this. And we're going to get to that piece a little bit later. But thank you.
Chief, how about on West End, walking on West Coast Drive, all the way down from Nashville to Starnville? I haven't found a lot of youth. I said, so for the park, and the guys been helping me, I tell them about it, they can run.
Got it down.
If you can put up your hand ahead of time, that way I'll get there faster.
So it's the beaches and where else did you say?
The beaches and all city parks.
And so what defines, is it like, would a West Coast Drive be considered the beach, or is it just a physical beach? I mean, like a parking lot of the lane, is that considered the beach? And just in general, what's the parameters?
Undefined.
That's a great idea, so.
Undefined yet?
Yeah.
So that has to be part of the discussion. I think the city attorney can weigh in on that.
The parks in the city are defined in the municipal code and very broadly includes San Lorenzo, Hardy West, the ocean side of West Cliff Drive, the wharf, all the beaches.
City Hall,
Pacific Avenue, the levee. So it's very broadly defined to include a lot of the public spaces in the city.
Chief Mills, what are your thoughts about how the ban might be enforced? Would the infraction be anything more than an add-on for something else that you're already speaking with somebody about?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
What are your thoughts about how the infraction would be enforced? Could you imagine writing a ticket for this infraction?
Oh, we most certainly would write tickets for these infractions.
That's not exactly my question. My question is, would somebody who receives a ticket for this infraction, is it just an add-on for something else. In other words, if you're searching somebody on the beach and you find a syringe, then you're going to be writing these tickets. Is there any other context for writing these tickets?
Well, normally in a police procedure, if we're contacting somebody for a legitimate cause, and we search them with the, you know, with the proper, in the proper way, then they'd be cited for that either as a standalone or in addition to other charges depending on the circumstances. So, for instance, if somebody had a dime bag of heroin on them, we would cite them for the heroin, then cite them for the citation if they're in that space. Give them both sites, as opposed to just one, or included on the same site. But
What about the areas associated with Lighthouse Field, which is state land? Is that under the jurisdiction of this as well? The parking lots, the little food court there where the restrooms are?
Okay, I think that you had the key word, which is state land. We cannot impose our will on state land. I think Rabbi had a question too.
So, how are you going to connect the needle with necessarily a person? In other words, is the infraction only because you see someone with a needle? And how are you going to publicize this?
So those are two good questions. One is we have to have the person in possession of that needle. So if there's a needle on the ground and you and I happen to be standing there having a cup of coffee together, that's not our possession. It has to be in their physical possession. Now, if I'm walking up and I see you throw it on the ground, it's still your needle. So you would get a cite for that, plus probably a cite for litter on top of it. How we would publicize this is a variety of ways. One, the council process. Two, it's going to have a 30-day, if it were approved by council, it would be 30 days before we could actually enact it and then market it as widely and as broadly as we can to people everywhere, that you cannot possess a needle in the park or on the beach. And half of this, you know, half of this problem-solving effort is being able to educate people. And so we certainly would want to do that at a time as much as possible.
Yeah, is this ordinance modeled on any other communities' ordinance? And if so, was there any research done that showed that this was an effective policing strategy?
It is not modeled on any other city's ordinance that we're aware of. There may be some out there, and so we would have to measure it before and after to see if the cause and effect is there, including the educational piece, to see how effective it would be.
What would you recommend for us as community members if we see someone with a needle, for example? Can we call it in to dispatch?
You can call it in to dispatch, and that will give us enough cause to contact the person. And then depending on what we find once we're there, the officer would have to assess whether or not there's enough legal reason to ask them or to search for that needle. And, you know, I'd rather not get inundated with calls.
Right.
This will be more of a proactive thing where we're out there in the sensitive areas, whether at quads on the beach during the summer when the junior lifeguards are there or on the levee,
right.
You know, that's when we're most likely to come across this. I was walking down the levee not too long ago and saw a guy with a needle in his arm. You know, I feel sorry for the guy that is addicted, but at the same time, that's not the place that we need needles.
Right.
So, okay, I don't want to get too hung up on this.
Last
guy.
One.
Eight more to go.
Last one.
Yes.
Well, Rabbi raised an interesting question, which is how you associate a needle with a person. Maybe this is overly simplistic thinking, but we live in an age of barcode and microchips. Why is it not possible during the issuing of needles to somebody who's a user to have a barcode associated with them so that they have to return that precise amount and individual syringe, or they are accountable for it if it's found elsewhere?
I thought you were going to put a tin foil hat on first and talk about barcoding. That's actually a great idea. If we're going to hand out needles to people, put a barcode on it.
Well, responsibility is the issue, right?
Right.
That's what they're trying to get.
Totally, that's a great idea, thank you. And that might be a step above my pay grade, however, I do think that that is a potential solution to eliminate needle litter everywhere, not just in one location. So good, thank you so much. I got a couple good notes off of this, so thank you for your input on that. Tony, anything else you want to add on this?
On the needle issue, I think that it would entail really fundamentally changing the way hypodermic needles are distributed in the community today, including by the County Health Department, because I don't believe that they have any process or even a mechanism for tracking the needle from the time that it's distributed to the time that it's hopefully turned back in or exchanged. So, great suggestion, but I think we're a long way from having a viable process for implementing something like that at this point.
We'll go to the next goal, and if we have time at the end, we can come back, so save your question.
Just write them down, and I can certainly talk to people afterwards.
Yes, thank you.
Say, goal number two is expand the public park boundaries throughout downtown Santa Cruz, allowing greater control and regulation of repeated nuisance crimes. So the thought process was, and I wrote from 900 to 1500, but others have emailed me since and said, please make it the entire Pacific Avenue. This becomes complex. I checked with Lee Butler, our planning director and economic development is Bonnie Lipscomb. And so one of the things we're researching is how will this affect development in the downtown area? If it's considered a park, can you actually build now in a park? So we're doing some more research into that, and we want to make sure that if we're going to do this, we can get it correct. So the whole idea behind this is, when we're in a park and you committed a public offense of some kind, such as litter, possession of needle park, whatever, we can say, okay, because you've done this, you cannot come back to this park for 24 hours. Or then it can be expanded to 72 hours. And then it starts over again. So it's a temporary way of keeping people out of these places who are becoming problematic. That's the purpose behind this expansion of the ordinance. Now, evidently, it's already designated as a park. Is that correct, Tony?
Pacific Avenue is included in the list of parks that are identified in the municipal code. It's chapter 13.04 of the municipal code. It lists all of the different parks, and Pacific Avenue is identified as a park in the code as well.
So, just think of all the reasons behind this and all the difficulties. So one of the difficulties is, if the police tell you can't come downtown for a 24-hour period, well, you can't shop downtown either. So we're concerned about that. What about people coming out of the clubs and smoking downtown? Do we say, okay, you can't come back down here for 24-72 hours, and all of a sudden, businesses don't have customers? So there's a variety of complexities here that we're taking a look at and studying to make sure that we have the legal right to do this, and that it won't significantly adversely affect the businesses. So what has to weigh are the behaviors that are associated with this outweighing the business impact, the potential business impact. I can just give you an example. Bernie Escalante is sitting in the back of the room. His MBT team arrested one gentleman down there 100-plus times, sitting on the bench every day, urinating, defecating, throwing up, leaving beer bottles, food all over the place, took him to jail, and every time he took him to jail, we wound up having to take him to the hospital to get cleared. So it was an enormous time and expense to everybody. As part of the FIT program that we participate in with the Sheriff's Office, he went to jail, courts gave him an ultimatum: rehabilitation or jail. He chose jail for a short period of time, didn't wind up choosing rehabilitation halfway through his sentence. Long story short, I don't think I've seen him in 6 months. So there's just an anecdotal story of how this could work. Is we have to get a little bit tougher with some of these folks by saying that we're not going to permit this in our downtown area. It's the economic engine of the city, we need to protect it. And so that's the process behind it.
Questions?
Chief Mills, you went out of your way in the beginning to suggest that this, these suggestions were not going to affect homeless people. A lot of homeless people are on Pacific Avenue, and inasmuch as this city, as far as I know, still has a ban against sleeping, does not this suggestion, would this suggestion not impact on the ability of people without shelter to sleep on Pacific?
So, Rabbi, thanks for that comment, but let me just correct something. I didn't say this wouldn't affect homeless people. This is not targeted for homeless people. It won't solve the problem of homelessness. And so I want to be very clear about that. It will affect homeless people. It will affect house people. It will affect anybody who is exhibiting the behaviors that we as a community, is against the norm of the community, whether you're homeless or not. So could it affect homeless people? Absolutely. Yes, it will. And sleeping in the doorways depends on the doorway. Many of the businesses have letters of authority or letters of agency on file that they don't want people sleeping in their doorway. And so we certainly could go and issue tickets for trespassing in those doorways and say you can't come back down here for 24 hours. So, full disclosure, it absolutely could happen.
But again, we're not just talking about doorways, we're also talking about benches, for example.
No. No, just to clarify this, and we're going to get to the camping piece here in a little bit. We do not issue tickets currently for sleeping in public. Period. Trespassing, yes. Sleeping in public, no. So, next question. Definitely waiting back.
I know, man. I told myself I would answer any questions, but here we go. It's not really a question. So, I don't know the police department, your task, but I do understand the difficulty of multiple citations and what to do, but using a park concept to blanket over a downtown business district as a way of, as a device to do what you need to do seems inappropriate. I wish there was some other way for you to do that rather than using something to protect the parks and then turning the downtown business district into a park. Everybody knows it's not a park. I wish we were seeing more benefits. That's a thought, you know, turning a business district into a park in so much that you can police it in a different manner. It seems inappropriate to me.
I just had a quick question of clarification. Currently, Pacific Avenue is considered a park. Can you define what part of Pacific Avenue? And what was it you were saying the goal was to expand what?
Well, my goal was originally 900 to 1500, but it has people have asked for it to go all the way to the clock tower down to the end of Pacific Avenue to Laurel. I'm open. You know, we're trying to find the right resolution for our city that we can come to consensus with. Tony, do you want to answer the other part?
What is it currently? I think that's what she's asking.
The code isn't very clear on that. It just says Pacific Avenue, but I think people have raised an important point. A park is a facility that we can post hours and close, but it's much different when you're dealing with a public thoroughfare like a street or a sidewalk. And so while we could establish rules that prohibit people from going downtown at certain hours of the day, we have a couple problems with that. One is that some people are legitimately just using the street at odd hours, like people who are making deliveries or insomniacs. Another problem is that there are services and facilities in the downtown area that people need access to, like the post office. And so, so when we go to court and ask for a court to order someone to stay away from a park, that's fairly straightforward for the courts to wrap their thoughts around and to issue an appropriate order. But if it's for the downtown area, then the courts take into consideration, you know, does that person need to go to an appointment, to a medical appointment, to the post office, to use any other public services or facilities in the downtown, like the Social Security office. So it's more complicated when you deal with an area that is encompassing city streets and sidewalks.
decide at what point someone gets the notice that it's either jail or rehabilitation? That was not clear.
That's part of the FIT program. So they have multiple arrests. When they go to jail, under that FIT program, they have to have tons of arrests. I'm not talking about 2 or 3 or even 10. We're talking a lot of arrests. There isn't a clearly defined number if that's what you're looking for.
I'm looking for a standard so that it's equally applied. So that people have noticed that, okay, this is your fourth offense. Now we're at this juncture where you need to go one way or the other.
Yeah, again, we're not talking 4 or 5 offenses. We're talking 30 to 50 on average.
And if so, why? Why 30 to 50?
It's who rises to the top. We take that from our officers, mm-hmm. of who's been the most problematic downtown and who's created the most, you know, generated the most arrests, or who has been called in on the most, those kind of things. So who's the most violent? There's a variety of things they do. There's not, to answer your question, there's not a hard defined number or process that's currently used.
So the determination is really one of what is it costing the city to deal with the person who rises to the top?
Yeah, not necessarily a financial number, but a
cost,
the cost of, yes, the cost of business. Tony, did you want to add something?
Yeah, it's not just the cost of the city, it's what's the cost of processing people through the court system. If we were able to effectively arrest someone and put them in jail for a misdemeanor violation of multiple open container tickets or littering in public or public defecation, we had an effective way to deal with that through the criminal justice system. That would be a different story, but the courts, we could fill up the jails with people like that, and we would need a lot more space in the jails. So the courts, the police department, it starts with the police department, it goes to my office, it goes to the courts, and it's an attempt to triage the most serious cases and to focus on the ones that are creating the most problems in a way that the courts don't just get impatient with us and start just dismissing cases. So we have to find a delicate balance. What's an appropriate level of enforcement, and what can the courts handle?
So,
last question on this one then.
Making it into a park, what's the difference in enforceability or rules? Like I heard you say the 24 or 48 hour stay away, that's just an officer deciding that didn't go to court as a stay away. But what else does making a park do?
That's the primary thing that we're after, is the ability to tell people you can't come down here for 24 hours. Because that helps regulate the behavior. If they really want to be down there, that really helps regulate the behavior. Now, permanent stay orders go through Tony's office. This is just an effort for us to control behavior for a short period of time.
And I forgot to make an announcement early on. Through those double doors if you need a restroom. Okay. Sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
I just want to ask a question about vendors.
About what?
Vendors.
If Pacific is a park, and as we know, there's a lot of people who do vending on Pacific Avenue, including strange people that sell their books, would that impact on vendors? Not soliciting, but vending.
So, yes, there are people who are strange ones who sell their book and ride around with a dog in their basket.
Yeah.
But vending is now permissible by state law. And we cannot control that at all. Well, at this point we can. But that's not something we can say. So goal number 3, reduce daytime campers in public spaces to promote public health, safety, and recreational activities. Essentially, this would mean that you can't have a tent up during the daytime. And we're defining the daytime as 7 in the morning to 10 at night. And Tony, I know the city attorney's been working diligently on multiple ordinances, and I think we've passed back and forth about 300 times. I can't imagine my billable hours on this. And so, Tony, do you want to jump in on this? And the whole idea is that people need to sleep, and we understand that. But to have a tent up on Water Street Bridge during the daytime, does that make sense for our community? In a lot of other places. So that's the thought process.
So you've all probably heard of this Ninth Circuit decision called Martin versus the City of Boise. And in the Martin case, the Ninth Circuit said, in general, that so long as there is a greater number of homeless individuals in a jurisdiction than the number of available beds and shelters, the jurisdiction cannot prosecute homeless individuals for involuntary sitting, lying, and sleeping in public. That is, so long as there is no option of sleeping indoors, the government cannot criminalize indigent homeless people for sleeping outdoors on public property on the false premise that they had a choice in the matter. Then the court went on, however, to say that its decision was a narrow one and that the holding does not cover individuals who do have access to adequate temporary shelter, whether because they have the means to pay for it, because it's realistically available to them for free, but who choose not to use it. Nor do we suggest that a jurisdiction with insufficient shelter can never criminalize the act of sleeping outside, even where shelter is unavailable, an ordinance prohibiting sitting, lying, or sleeping outside at particular times or in particular locations might well be constitutionally permissible. So we looked at that in an effort to come up with an amendment to our municipal code that essentially adheres to what the Ninth Circuit case said in the Martin versus Boise decision. And the options that we laid out for the council were A, consider prohibiting setting up an encampment during daylight hours. And that would not prohibit people from sleeping, say, in a park, in the grass during the daytime, but it would restrict the ability of people to set up encampments and to leave them on the sidewalk or in a street or in a park during daylight hours. The intent here is to recognize that until we have some mechanism for providing shelter to people who are homeless and have no alternative, we need to be able to just come to grips with the fact that that people are going to have to sleep outside somewhere. So the draft that we came up with said that, one, no setting up an encampment during the daylight, and two, no camping during nighttime hours. However, before the city could cite someone or arrest them for camping during nighttime hours between 10 a.m. and 6 a.m., I believe, we would have to have a shelter option available to them and offer it, and they would have to decline it before we would move forward with enforcement action. And so that was the concept. The third exception that I mentioned is that the court said that would not prohibit the city from prohibiting camping anytime in certain locations or under certain circumstances. And that means, that says to me that the city could prohibit camping citywide if we had an alternative location where we could point people to say, this area is camping allowed, therefore you can't camp here. The real crux of the problem is, where is that location? And the city has struggled with the question, what is an appropriate location to make available for homeless people to camp? We haven't found one yet.
Rick?
So, speaking about, you know, hours is fine, but with regard to location, seems to me the easily enforceable ordinance would be 3% of a mile, say 150 feet, no camping anytime within, let's say, 150 feet of a facility that caters to children, such as a public park, Boys and Girls Club, etc., or a private residence. So that wouldn't prohibit people from sleeping outside, but it would prohibit people from sleeping from setting up a camp within, let's say, X number of feet to be determined from a private residence, including an apartment building or whatever, private home, and a facility that caters to children. It seems to me that would be easy to enforce. It wouldn't prohibit people from sleeping outside. It had nothing to do with time. It only has to do with location and proximity to private residences and children's areas.
I completely agree with your statement. But I think it, what you have to keep in mind is that it's very easy to identify areas where camping or setting up an encampment is prohibited. What is not as easy is to say where should it be allowed, and that's where the decision making gets difficult. But you're right, if we were able to do that, then we could have a much more effective enforcement tool in those areas where camping is prohibited. The key is find some place where it's not prohibited.
I mean, it's a question of appropriateness. Is it appropriate to have a campground where people, some people, not all, certainly, I'm not going to stereotype all the people, or people on the street, but is it appropriate to have people camping, such as right in front of the child play area at Loudon Mills and Laurel Park? It just doesn't seem that's a great place to have it. But if it were 150 feet away and it weren't near a private residence or another park, fine, who's going to complain about that? But just...
homelessness by virtue of the fact that we have so many students here.
it appears to me that the university plays absolutely no role in the solution of this, including with their own students. From what I understand, they won't even allow their own students who are living in vehicles to stay on campus. Now, the governor just announced that he is going to try to utilize underutilized state space. It seems to me no more appropriate place that we have that has a great, tremendous amount of open space is the university, at least for their students, but I would extend it to the general homeless population who are most in need of some of the things that that university provides, which is education and opportunities. I don't know why the university and the homeless community don't need more to try to find more educational opportunities to bring people out of homeless and to provide a space in a huge campus at least to house their own students who are unhoused.
Thank you, Deborah. As a follow-on to what Steve was just saying, only a week ago, the governor tasked every city and county with the job of identifying such spaces. Has that figured into what you've been working on here? Available spaces for various kinds of shelter.
Well, I can tell you this. I've only been here about 2.5 years, and there is not one meeting I've been to with my colleagues where that hasn't been a discussion, and at the city council level also. I mean, it's truly, we've looked at hundreds of properties. Poor Bonnie Lipscomb, who does is our property management, you know, person, I think we drive her crazy. So, you know, suggesting what the space is, and Martine Bernal regularly pulls up the map, and we're all looking at it. Well, what about this spot? We did it this morning, I'm pretty interesting, and looking at different spots. Then, you know, hopefully, like the property on North Ocean Extension, which
1930 Ocean Street Extension.
Yeah, 1930 Ocean Street Extension. Somebody said we might be able to lease that, so we pull up on the satellite and take a look at it. You know, so that's there's possibilities. It's the community having the will to actually site something, and that's where it becomes difficult.
You know, I don't have a question, but I just want to say that I support the ordinance as you have it written. And the reason why, because it's pretty obvious to people who have lived here almost any amount of time that it is an issue. When you see camps set up at the side of Staff of Life on Soquel Avenue, when you have 5 or 6 guys in shopping carts blocking a sidewalk on Lodge Street, and especially downtown, right by the mill, the post office, where you see mounds of people just laying on the ground with dirt built around them, and you can see the rats scurrying around. So even though it may not be for everybody, even though I would like it to be for everybody, the thing people need to remember is the chronic people, the chronic issues. It's just the tool to get these chronic peoples out of the way and give them the help that they need so they don't be out on the streets.
I live on Washington Street, just a few doors down from the encampment on Washington Street next to Laurel Park. It's been there for a couple months. My question is about enforcement, because it would be, you're talking about an ordinance for no tents. Well, this is a well-established encampment that 100% blocks the sidewalk. That's illegal today. But I don't know, and I saw a few officers out there one day talking to them. I know the center is trying to deal with it, they hired a security guard. But they're in violation by blocking the sidewalk, and it doesn't seem like there's a good way to enforce that.
So I'll answer this one, but I don't want to get into specific problems because we'll be here all night. So Washington Street is a problem. Our officers are over there on a regular basis, talking to people and citing them. We are the ones that hire the security guard for Park and Rec, just to try and give them a little bit of more space. And this is part of the problem. Until we cite something, a place for them to be, it's pretty difficult to say you gotta get them to go. So we're gonna have some other solutions later to give a little bit more teeth into what we're doing. But those folks have been cited multiple times. And
they just
put it
away and then they move back.
Well, yeah. So they do that on Coral Street, they do that on Washington, they do it by the post office, they do it Again, we can go to 19,000 places in the city where this is taking place on a daily basis. I recognize it's frustrating for people. That's why we're trying to push this forward. The gentleman in the back with the pink shirt has his hand up for a while.
So,
the algebra.
Before you do that, okay. I would just like to follow up on this person's comment. You're right that people who are camping on Washington Street right now are doing it in violation of our existing camping ordinance. The problem is that we can't enforce it. So what we're proposing is, rather than a blanket prohibition on camping, for instance, I mean, a person sleeping on the sidewalk in the middle of the night might be causing a problem for someone, but it's not a huge problem. What is a big problem is when people set up, sleep there at night, and then leave their junk and their tent and their belongings and debris for days on end. What we're trying to do is narrow the focus to the nuisance aspects of that behavior. So if a person were to sleep on Washington Street on the sidewalk at night but had to pick up and move their belongings in the morning, it would still be a problem, but it wouldn't be as much of a problem. So that's why we're trying to narrow the focus with a set of targeted regulations that allow us to deal with the nuisance conditions, not necessarily just the sleeping, which is something that's going to happen as long as we have more homeless people in this city than we have shelter spaces to provide them.
So, I have an opportunity here. These are our two interns that are chosen by the Chancellor. This is Devon and this is Sunny. And they meet with us at the beginning of the year and they work on projects and to help the community and the university understand or come together on certain issues. So they come to all of our meetings and they're referring to Rochelle to make her statement. This is Rochelle Moran, who is also in community relations at the university.
Thank you, Debbie. But I just want to say real quickly, somebody mentioned housing. When we have a student who's living in a car, we get them help. We try to get them out of their car and into real housing. We don't allow students to park on campus in their car, live in their car, because that is not an ideal situation. It's not healthy, and we don't have facilities for students to be able to do that and ensure their security. So we do look for housing for these folks, as we think that that's a better solution than just allowing people to park in their cars on campus. We also have a situation, too, where people will, you know, if we allow students to park in their car, even if they could afford rent, maybe they would park in their car. So that's something that we really want to address, because we think the standard should be remained that people should live in their cars.
Okay, should we move on?
Yeah. Oh, we have one more. Last question.
Me too.
Or last comment.
I also live on Washington Street and use the Loud Nelson Center and the encampment, because of the amount of stuff that they have. There's a person there with a double mattress and a chest of drawers. And almost donated my lamps, but it seems like the amount of stuff just keeps accumulating and gets bigger and bigger, which is now taking over the whole sidewalk. So if I was to call and complain that I couldn't get through there, and you went over to the encampment, would you have already checked across the street at the Salvation Army Warming Center to see if they had space before you issued a ticket to them? Or what is the procedure there?
So the procedure is we check as best we can to see if there's space available. We're working on the app so the officers in the field can pull up immediately and then say, there's space available right now. Are you willing to go? Yes, I am. Great. Let's get your stuff and go. And again, get them out of there. Bernie Escalante is taking notes in the back, and we'll continue to try to address Washington Street as much as we can. But just let me just comment on one thing you said about chest of drawers and a double mattress and so forth.
Wow.
The issue is, a lot of residents put this on the sidewalk for people to take.
Thank you.
And that's not healthy for the community, because what winds up happening is Mr. Devil's people have to go and pick it up.
Mark, do you want to address that at all?
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Sanitation is part of public works, and we have one person in a truck, sometimes two people dedicated, full-time driving around picking up. People think they leave a sofa or, you know, debris on the sidewalk with a three sign. If we can get to it, we'll pick it up, but a lot of times it ends up in this homeless camp, and then we go and have to help pick it up after there, too. So you're not helping, your neighbors and yourself by that. There are online, you know, there are online services that you can put free, and someone can, you can make an arrangement. If you want to give it away, that's a great thing, because it doesn't go in the landfill. But don't just leave it on the sidewalk with a free sign. That's really, it just compounds the problem. And you'll see that sofa move around your neighborhood or someone else's neighborhood.
I saw one just recently that was down by Broadway, and that wound up in the river. And so that's the kind of stuff that just, you know, it's just unhealthy all the way around. Okay, goal number four, let's keep moving, because I'm an hour right now, and it's long meetings. Reduce bike theft in chop shops. The idea is to create an ordinance that prohibits the tearing down of bicycles, more than one bike at a time, in public space. Doesn't affect private space, doesn't affect your front yard, it's public space only. And we've all seen this where, and we see it on a regular basis, where there's 20, 30 bikes at a time. And we regularly go and contact those folks and take a look at it and run the serial numbers on the bikes to see if they're stolen. If they're stolen, we arrest people for possession of stolen property. But not a lot of people register their bikes. And so we go, we try very hard. Janini is back here, and how many bikes have you guys registered this last couple months?
About 275.
Yeah. So we're really making some efforts with our volunteer program, and you can sign up to be a volunteer and help register bikes, to register as many bicycles as we can, because that gives us the advantage when we're dealing with this. So the idea, again, is to stop the environmental degradation by people spray painting bikes in open space, by tearing them down, leaving parts all over the place, and go from there. So, your thoughts on that?
So, for clarification, so if someone is riding down the street with a couple of bikes, that's not what you're looking for. They're at a park, and you can see three, four bikes all in pieces. That's what it's right.
Correct. You know, a week ago, I was walking down to City Hall, and a person was walking across the street with two bicycles, and I said, hey, because it's not kind of uncommon to, you know, for a person to have two bikes. So what are you doing? And they said, oh, this was free. I'm like, oh yeah, right. Well, I look over, and there's three more bikes with little signs on them that says free, take them. And the person was 100% accurate that was a free bicycle. So again, the same story, just you there. So we want to be very careful that it's not people with just possession of two bikes, because a lot of people have possessions of bikes. But what we're talking about is the tearing down and chopping up and remodeling of bikes in a public space. You're changing a tire, changing your brakes, changing chain, obviously no problem. But that can and is done when we haul this right bikes and get a flat and take it off and do all that. But thoughts or questions on that?
Yeah, I have a suggestion on the registration program. It's great that we do the registration, but if you remember back in the 70s, chop shops were one of the major ways that the mafia made money. And the reaction to that was to not only put a serial number on the major components like an engine and a transmission, but actually have that information stamped on every body panel so somebody couldn't take apart. So another suggestion, another tinfoil hat kind of suggestion would be to have more than one, all of them have there the same number, but have more than one emblem so you could put it on the major components, like the wheels, like the seat, like the handlebars, so they would all have to match.
So thank you. We're also looking at other technology, that's a great suggestion, including it's called smart water, or DNA water. so you can spray it on your bike and you can look it under a black light and get the who that bike belongs to. So there's a variety of technologies out there that can allow us to do that. It's invisible, so you can ride your bike and you don't have thermal spray paint all over it. The person who would have to pick up, who does a lot of picking up bikes, by the way, is Public Works. And we also, you know, so this impacts a lot of things, including storage. Do you want to say anything about
that? Yeah, I mean, one thing you can do when you take your bike downtown, make sure you lock it properly. If you leave one of your tires unlocked, it may not be there when you get back. We do have a bike locker program, which is really effective for, it's 5 cents an hour. It's very safe if you want to use it for a bike and bike locker. That's the safest way. But we hear hundreds of stories where somebody says, oh, I just left my bike for 5 minutes and go to the store and it came out and was gone. Yeah, it will. If you leave your bike out overnight, part of it will be gone. It'll just be part of it. It's a real problem in this community, the bike theft. It's huge. And we really promote safe bicycle transportation, so that has to go hand in hand. So we have some information on our website as far as, you know, proper how to block your bike and that type of thing, but the block safe bike.
And the volunteers also got a presentation on a dog program. And this dot is like so itty bitty, but it has a unique number on it. And you can get like 20 dots. So you could put them all over your bike.
Is there any outreach to the bicycle businesses to ask them to, when somebody's buying it, to actually get the serial number?
So registration at the point of sale is the most effective way we have of getting all new bikes registered. Yeah. And the problem is that there's a lot of turnover in salespeople at bicycle shops, so we're having to increase the amount of time that the volunteers go to bike shops and offer training to the current sales staff. But yes, that is a current, that's a program, and if you were to buy a bike today, at any one of our major bike shops, you would get a chance to register your bike right there.
Theoretically.
Okay.
Theoretically. So, you ready to move on?
Yeah.
Okay, great, thank you. Goal 5, reduce overnight vehicles and other vehicles on West Cliff Drive. Those those campus West Cliff Drive. Community out there put in a Verizon camera and measure the time people are parking in the spots on West Cliff Drive over a year's period of time. Hundreds of thousands of transactions, and through artificial intelligence, we're able to determine the optimal amount of time one can stay there and still enjoy the scenery and surf and all that kind of thing, but as well as freedom so everybody can use it and reduce the amount of problems associated with long-term parking. I think the experience is the longer people stay and drink and smoke and all that kind of thing, the problems escalate. So I really want to thank those community members for doing that. Al back here is one of them. And so it gave us a pretty good insight of what's going on. What we found is that 95% of people park for 2 hours or less. 6% of all parking events consume 31% of parking spaces. So the trail principle, small amount of numbers, create the biggest amount of usage. So yes, we continue to do that. Parking is actually Public Works, so what did Director Dell to address that?
Yeah, it was an interesting experiment, actually. We actually monitored 18 spots parking off the Cal's steps. And we could monitor them 24/7. Digitally, the data was collected, analyzed, and we could see availability, we could see types of vehicles, and even the technology allowed us to monitor the traffic that went by that, as well as the bicycle and pedestrian traffic on the path. So we didn't have pictures of people, but we had actual monitoring numbers. So you can see turning movements, people turning into the parking and exiting the parking. So we took this data and it enabled us to look at kind of durations of parking and like Chief Bills talked about, majority of the parkers, 85%, were under 2 hours. So you can look at that data and say, we need parking limits on that time, on that section of parking to help encourage turnover and free that parking up for more visitors as they come through. And the other option we looked at is they put the duration of the parking and with the police incidents. So they kind of looked at time of day, police incidents. And obviously, no surprise, is in the evening, later it got and the parking, people parked there after it closed, theoretically closed. That parking closes at 10 p.m. Or actually midnight, I guess, midnight to 6 a.m. We still had a lot of numbers of calls in the area. After hours, the calls spiked up compared to their western. So people parking there when they shouldn't be, drinking, and that type of thing happens. But we'll use that tool. We're looking at maybe one potential scenario was to look at if we were to have limited parking or charge for parking, what could that do and how would that encourage turnover? We're still in the evaluation phase of that. It's kind of an interesting tool to use technology to gain information, real data. We haven't had that type of data before.
Okay, yeah. I think it's a great idea. Again, I think a serve session is about 2.5 hours. That's what it really is, right? That's what it is. But that doesn't include the parking lot of the lane, though, right? That's parkland, right?
Right.
And so we can't do anything about that. All right. So I know we're talking about like what we can do as a community to you know once again deal 5% of this behavior in town right here. But so for someone like me, it's incredibly frustrating. And so I'm always wondering, like, what am I allowed to do as far as confronting that behavior, right? What, like, me or like the citizens, like, what are we, like, what's our limits and are we allowed to confront this bad behavior, you know? So.
So.
My comment that I always say to neighbors is don't engage, because bad things can happen.
I'm not going to be that way. I'm going to engage.
So let me just make a quick comment on that. I want to be very careful about this because what I don't want to see is any kind of vigilantism. That's unacceptable to me. I think it's unacceptable to our greater community. However, we've spent a lot of great time and treasure as a department training multiple community groups how to de-escalate situations as opposed to ramp them up. There are ways to approach people and to talk with them and to try to come to an understanding. And then if it's not working, then I think it's important to back off and then let us do it, our officers do it. So you certainly have a right to free speech. You certainly have the right to confront issues that you see in behaviors. But I want to be very careful that it doesn't turn into going to blows and or becoming a hostile situation. I would much rather have people try to de-escalate it, talk low and slow to people, back off if needed, and let us come and handle it as best we can. Our officers have the tools to be able to do that. Sorry, Alec.
I was just going to add, you were talking about surfers. I'm going to, yeah, thanks.
I don't get off the mic.
This reminds me of my mom. Hey, I'm Al, and this is my wife Christine Doyle. I know some of you know me, but I probably spend 5 hours a day on West Cliff or in the water near West Cliff. I'm a very keen surfer, and we have had this project going for about 18 months, as Chief Mills says, to actually measure what actually happens in these parking lots. I think we all have anecdotal information, but the data is this. And the truth is that, as Mark said, 95% of people park for less than 2 hours. Okay? And that there's a group of people, 5 or 6%, that represent 31%. That's just not fair for the community. That's my view. Second thing is, the parking lots on West Cliff, I think there's 18 of them from Dream Inn around to Natural Bridges. They all have similar characteristics, but some of them are located right next to residences and other of them next to state parks. And so there's probably slight differences between those, but fundamentally I think it probably looks like this. The other thing is, and again to address the question of the state parks, the two lots on the west side, so on the non-beach side of West Cliff Drive, next to the toilets and the steamer supply, they are the state parks, and the others are all city. we've spoken to everybody, state parks as well as the city, and one thing that came up which I think was very surprising was that there's 50 parking lots, state park parking lots, between Monterey and San Francisco. You probably know the Manresa, Ananuevo, you name it, anywhere up the coast. Every single one of them are paid parking lots. If you go into any one of those parking lots, everyone knows this, you pay 10 bucks for a day, or you can buy a pass, which we all the servers do, so we can go to Ananuevo, Manresa, and anywhere else, costs 120 bucks a year. Why is it, in my mind, why is it that this parking lot is free? Makes no sense.
Good point.
Right? It really makes no sense. And the other thing is that 80%, this is our estimates just based on conversations with people. I've had literally hundreds of conversations, and I've seen all of the conversations across the board. About 80% of the people who park in these lots are actually from out of town. And so if we were going to implement parking restrictions, for example, 3 hours, I think you mentioned 2.5 hours as a service station, it's probably right if you're young. If there was charging for that, like there is in many other places, like Capitol, anyone been to Capitol recently? You know, they charge there. Many Live Oaks, lots of places around here. It's not going to be unfamiliar to those people as well, those 80% coming out of town. And I think the benefit of doing that, in addition to being able to enable the police to be able to regulate it and enforce it, because if you've been there for more than 3 hours, you get a ticket, right? Just like you do anywhere else. And that enables enforcement. But the benefit is, to the community I'm talking about now, that revenue can go back into beautifying and cleaning up this area that we so love. So that's the conversation. There's no hard, fast decisions in our minds at this point in time. Love any feedback on this stuff. Like I said, I have hundreds of conversations about this every day.
Great, thank you. So, questions?
You were saying tickets, but we all know that the crime of having a parking ticket and the price of paying a parking ticket is way beyond the crime. They just increased them a lot after the Prop 13 hoax that was pushed on people. So ticketing is an unfair thing to suggest, I think. And I hate protests too. Just kidding. But I think we need to welcome people, you know, be more loving, less hateful. And one other thing is, we're fighting crime. Why don't we consider corporate crime? Who considers corporate crime?
We're sticking to the rules here. What are we discussing?
It's 100 times worse than street crime. I know you want to censor me, but
let's move on. Any other questions on this topic?
Corporate crime.
We'll ask you to leave if you're not following the rules here. Okay, any other questions? Okay. Last question on this topic.
So we're talking about affordable housing in my mind. VRBs, tents, cars, so it is a form of affordable housing, and so those units. How are we matching that? I mean, if we're just pushing people around, like you said, that's not very loving. I actually have another approach. You know, my name's Wes, I'm with a homeless union, and so I advocate for homeless. And basically, if, like when you're talking about behavior, I'd be looking for organized space. I mean, you don't want to see them blanking trash, and that's one of the biggest issues, and you don't want people committing crime, that's certainly a huge issue. That would be a lot more easy if, you know, I'm a teacher, so I'm used to assigned seats. I don't know, especially if I'm subbing, I don't know anybody's name of anything, but if I know where they sit, I can catch them. And same thing with people, you know, it's a range of affordable housing. It may not be brick and mortar, but it is affordable housing. And how are we going to respect these people? Because I know a lot of people who work, and the 10 to 7 thing is not going to work because there's not enough time, you know, from setting up to picking it all up and still be within that window, and you know, sleep on top of that, on top of the stress of what am I going to do with all my stuff during the day? You know, we just need to allow people to be somewhere. And what I hear from everything so far is how to black out the checkerboard and leave it no place to be, and maybe a concentration camp somewhere outside of city limits. And I'm not sure
that's a productive way to go, but this is certainly the pattern you've been doing, so I can see why you continue to do it this way.
Can we go to KOA? Because that's a camp for RVs and things like that, so we can always tell them to go to KOA.
There's a whole list of camp spaces. And do you want to address safe spaces?
Well, we're in favor of having safe space for people to be. I know that the narrative or the mantra is, you know, trying to black out the boards and nobody can stay anywhere in town. That's just not the case. I mean, we've worked ourselves to bones trying to find spaces for people. And yes, you know, the homeless union sued us and took us to federal court and lost.
Yeah.
Here we are. And now we're trying to push forward with solutions, including finding safe spaces for people, including my own front lot, where I have two people who are living in their motorhomes at nighttime. And because we're trying to find solutions. And it's real easy to be cynical and say it's been bad for government, but that is just generally not the case. We can disagree on policy, and we do disagree on policy vehemently with one another sometimes, but we need to move the needle forward, even if it's incremental. So, all right.
You have a lot of no, but hardly any yes.
Excuse me?
You have a lot of no and hardly any yes.
Okay.
People are not allowed to be in here, but you say there would be places for people to be.
Okay. Again, we're suggesting spots for people to go, including a yes of my own front lot. So I don't know where you're not seeing any, we're not giving any yeses.
For 1,200 people, 800 people?
Better than zero, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, let's move forward. Goal 6, allow police to have greater discretion and diversion strategies to boost effectiveness. So because so many people fail to appear on their tickets, it's not an effective strategy. What I'd much rather do is be able to divert them and keep them out of the justice system altogether. Is that a good enough yes? And the way of doing that is to give the officers discretion to be able to hold the ticket and say, Saturday, if you come and help us clean up a part of the city, let's do something positive for our city. We will not send this over to the city attorney's office for issue. Whatever the ticket is, I don't care if your house run house, that's not the point. It's the behavior again. So we'll hold this in abeyance. You come and help us clean up in the next Saturday or two, and then we'll help facilitate that. I'll be able to groom myself with them. But the point is, let them do something positive for our community, and then give the officers discretion to do that. The second piece, however, is to allow the officers discretion to make some of these misdemeanors in the field, so that there can be physical custody for those who are recalcitrant. To give us the opportunity to, if somebody has been cited multiple times and is not going with the norm of our community, which are our ordinances, to give the officers in the field the authority to make the misdemeanor arrest rather than just the infractions. I'll get to you in a second. One city in the state, San Diego, is doing a program where if you fail to appear on your citations, they turn into warrants. They'll give you a place to stay for 30 days. If you stay there for 30 days, the warrants go away. In other words, it's a little bit of leverage to say, let us help you take care of these warrants so that you can stay someplace for 30 days, and when they're in that, you wrap around services. So these are the positive things that I think we can do to help reduce the amount of a problem there.
For my personal observation, the Santa Cruz police is the most respectful and useful, positive that I've ever seen anywhere. This meeting is a proof of it, that the chief of police himself stands with the community to find solutions. And from my point of view, someone who has been living in the street for a year and a half now, I feel good each time I see the Santa Cruz police, because I know they're here to protect us. They're respectful, and I've never seen a Santa Cruz police person manhandling somebody, being rough or yelling, or so really there is a lot of hope for Santa Cruz, and I want to give personal thanks to the Santa Cruz police and to the chief of police for everything.
Thank you.
Officer discretion for misdemeanors, is that a blanket discretion for all citations that are infractions that could become misdemeanors, or is there a selection of ordinances for which that discretion would be applied to?
That's a very good question. I think that, in my opinion, it would probably be limited to the most to the offenses that are most offensive. And figure that out in moving that forward to council and letting them, manage which offenses might be able to do that, which ones not. I certainly want the city attorney to weigh in on that to make sure that we're in line with what he wants in terms of what he can and will prosecute. Okay, we're burning the daylight hours. One more left. And that is reduce shopping cart litter to reduce blight, public nuisance, and potential health and safety hazards. One of the things that some cities have done is to hold people accountable for their shopping carts. There is already state law that says you cannot take a shopping cart from somebody in town. Now that takes a police officer to write that citation, a ranger to see if someone can't do it, because it's a misdemeanor crime. So we can currently do that, but this goes beyond that. The idea is to tell these store owners that you are responsible for picking up your carts, and that if we have to pick them up, it's going to cost you in terms of us storing your cart for a period of time and us picking it up. It might be a good opportunity for somebody to have a business running around town picking up shopping carts. If you take a look at, anybody ever seen any WASPs shopping carts out in the street? No. Why? They got that stupid bar that goes way up, right? How many people see Costco carts around? A few, but not many. Why?
The wheels lock.
No, they pick them up. There's always something in that parking lot picking up those carts. Those are expensive carts. They don't want to lose them. On the other hand, there are other companies that we find them all day long out in this field, because they leave them on the parking lots without somebody picking them up. So this ordinance would compel the owners of those businesses to pick up their own carts and to keep them under control. Safeway and Mission, what do they have on their carts? The locking mechanism for the wheels. So there are easy technologies to employ. Even if it's a PVC pipe that goes 10 feet in the air, so you can't get out the door. So that's the purpose of this ordinance, to reduce the amount of shopping carts all over town. And that becomes something that I think is important for us to control the way. Questions on that? Kind of common sense, these things, huh?
So I know somebody just brought up that they wanted to see this list, and I know there's ongoing research going on, but I'll overstep a little bit. The chief is planning to bring this out to the community as well, with five different meetings throughout the whole community. So if your neighbors and friends did not get a chance to be here tonight, they will have other opportunities, and Santa Cruz neighbors will definitely be putting this out on next door, email lists, Facebook, everything that we can get out information to you.
So every one of these takes the ordinance, then it takes a staff report behind it and a justification for it, and it takes legal research to make sure that we're on solid footing, and then it goes to council and gets bounced around. So we'll present later, but we are going to do five community meetings in our city, just like we did when I first got here, and to go out to the community. We're expecting to do that sometime in March, but that's just as quick as I can humanly get it underway. So that's the get all that input, we'll make a thoughtful decision and then push it to council and get their direction. And so I think it'll be important for you to let your voice be heard, not only at meetings, but also to your council members. And I see one here today, Donna. And so we thank you for taking your time on
Okay, any last minute questions that did not get answered for comments?
We have 10.8. My other question is, do you have a tentative time frame in which to get a draft to the city council? I know you're saying March, but are we talking 6 months, a year?
Yes, I know government works that way, I would much rather get it summertime, if not before, to council. But I have to make sure that zoning staff has the opportunity to really spend some time vetting this so we make sure we do it correctly. My staff has to write it. Many of these are written somewhere. And that means also our staff has to look at it as well. So it's complex, but yes, we want to push this forward sooner rather than later.
And with some of these things, we can also look to other communities in the state of California, because that's sticking with state law. So any of you know specifically in other communities, it always helps to have that. You can email me that information or email the chief directly, amills@cityofsantacruz.com.
Did you say that eight?
Number seven.
I would be able to see the crime and somebody trying to keep their belongings with them when there are so few storage places and so few hours to even get your stuff out of the police department. It's not necessarily homeless people that are stealing from other homeless people. Eventually, homeless people lose all their stuff. I think that there's more of a crime in the hate of homeless people. I think we should all begin to love everybody a lot more and happy. New vision. Thank you.
One more.
Hi, I thought that question six was great after the first five, allowing legal enforcement officers greater strategies to keep the concentrated assistance. And I'm wondering if, for example, in San Diego, the warrants for 30 days, the wraparound services, if that's available to see somewhere? That's my question.
So that's a good question. Obviously, for us to do that, we have to have the county on board to do the wraparound services, since we don't have that in the city. That's not one of our, that's not our swim lane. So we are working on that with the city manager's office to make sure that the county is ready to do those kind of things. So we can't do that portion of it until we have that back end in place.
But I could find San Diego.
That's online.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, any municipal code.
I'll stick around if anybody has questions and have their comments.
Any city, I think, with research that I've done throughout the state of California, has municipal codes posted under their city website, so.
I'm speaking for myself, but I'd like to think I'm speaking for a lot of us. How fortunate we are to have a police chief who, while we don't always agree, as you pointed out, is proactive and concerned about the welfare of our community and brings suggestions to community and invites community to hear and to participate. For that, I think we all owe you a sense of gratitude.